Welcome back to Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway. And now a chat with another 2020 hopeful.
I'm Jay Inslee, governor of the state of Washington.
Jay Inslee spends a lot of time thinking about how to fight climate change. That makes it hard to make small talk with him about the weather.
It doesn't actually rain here. It's just, you know, it's just the liquid solar power. That's how we think of the rain.
yeah, okay. I'm not buying it. This month, Jay Inslee declared he's running for president, and climate change is his number one issue. According to a recent Pew survey, about 67% of Democrats see climate change as a top priority, but only 21% of Republicans feel the same way. I asked Governor Inslee how he plans to bring the country together over an issue that only half the country views as a top priority.
We can be united around a common vision of economic growth, and that's something that ought to unite us all and can unite us all. And what we know is that climate change is a great peril, but it is also a great promise. And it is a great promise of building a clean energy economy with millions of jobs in clean energy that affects so many different parts of our economy and in virtually every region in the United States. And I believe that America is very much a can-do nation. We're very much a group of optimists. We're forward-thinking. We're technological innovators. And when we create a vision where people can participate in that new economy, that can be a very uniting message. During my brief period in the race, that's what I've seen, where people are installing wind turbines in Iowa and solar panels actually in Washington State and building batteries in Nevada by the thousands for electric cars. So the economy is something that can unite us all. We want all of our children to have both air to breathe and a good job. And this is an issue that can accomplish both of those American visions.
President Obama, Hillary Clinton, a lot of other Democrats also made the same message that you can have both. Green new jobs are the jobs of the future. Don't worry, manufacturing states or big energy producing states. You're going to have as many or more jobs. But it doesn't seem to have sunk in, and it doesn't seem to be a message that works with voters in those states. So how are you going to be different in making that message than, say, President Obama or other Democrats?
I am the first person in American history to run for president with the very explicit and consistent and vocal message that defeating climate change has to be the number one priority in the United States. It has to be the first, foremost, and paramount obligation of the next president. And this can't be done as just putting it on your to-do list. It has to be the central organizing principle of the federal government, just as it was in defeating fascism, just like it was going to the moon. And if it is not job one, it won't get done. And I'm saying it has to be job one. And I believe that because I've been working on this for 20 years, co-authored a book about it 11 years ago, helped establish the Sustainable Environment and Energy Coalition, founded the U.S. Climate Alliance with Jerry Brown and Andrew Cuomo. So I've got experience to understand what is necessary, and that is you have to bring your capital to bear. You have to make it a central focus, and that includes removing the filibuster. You have to be willing to bring reform to Washington, D.C. to be able to get that done, and I'm the only candidate saying that as well. So I think my candidacy is unique. I think it matches the moment. Certainly Democrats totally get this. It's the number one priority tied with health care in the last Iowa Democratic poll.
So that in order to get really significant legislation, climate legislation through, you're arguing you need to get rid of the filibuster, because as long as the filibuster is there, there's no chance of big sweeping legislation passing. Is that your case that you're making?
Anyone who is really serious about tackling climate change, anyone who's actually committed to defeating climate change, has to be willing to say that the filibuster must go. There is no way on this green earth to get those supermajorities to pass meaningful climate change legislation and overcome a filibuster. So I'm outside of D.C. This is why sometimes it's helpful to have somebody from outside Washington, D.C. to go in and reform this antiquated, antediluvian tradition, which has prevented progress. Now, there's another reason to do that, which is this is an anti-democratic institution. There's nowhere in the Constitution to say that the people who want positive change get one vote, and the people who don't want positive change get 1.5 votes. And that's essentially what a filibuster is.
What about using something like the emergency declaration? This president is using it on the border wall. Would you use it for the environment?
Were I to be given the honor to go to the White House, I would want to work with Congress to fashion a very comprehensive mobilization of our efforts to defeat climate change. Now, if the rules change in this country to allow emergency declarations in some extraordinary way, any president would have to respond to that and use whatever tools are available in our democracy. But I believe the old way is the best, which is that Congress has to pass appropriations. We should have democracy where Congress actually has the power of the purse, and we should not allow a president to ignore the will of Congress.
You've been governor now since 2013. Point us to your biggest success on the issue of climate change in the state.
Well, our biggest success is actually developing right now, because I finally have a Democratic working majority, which has been a long time coming. We passed a bill through our House which will create a clean fuel standard to guarantee Washingtonians that they have cleaner, less polluting fuels. We've also passed a bill that requires 100% clean electricity. We're passing bills that will ban super pollutants and extend our effort to try to have electrification of our transportation fleet. And I'm very excited about the next few weeks to get those bills to my desk. Before that, we've had good success building a wind turbine industry to a $6 billion industry, putting thousands of people to work. We are having good success electrifying our transportation fleet. We're one of the top states as to the number of electric cars. We actually have the city with the most per capita use of electric buses, and we plan on building actually the first electric drive ferries to go along with our terrestrial electrification. But the point is, we have to do a lot more. The nature of this beast requires us all to pitch in and to raise our sights and our level of ambition. And I believe we can do that given the nature of who we are as the master innovators. This is what we do in America. We invent, we create, we build, and we need to raise our ambitions. And I've seen that happen when President Kennedy said we can go to the moon in 10 years and come back safely. And I believe that type of bugle call to rally Americans to their higher ambitions is very much needed and very much possible right now.
And speaking of what, you know, Americans answering the clarion call, you're also going to ask them to make some of their own sacrifices, whether that's in maybe higher taxes or in the cost of things, even in the short term going up on electric. I know in this last election, a ballot initiative on a carbon tax lost in your state. So maybe voters have a sense that they would like to do what you're asking them to do, but can they afford the cost? And what do you need to tell voters? Do you need to be honest with voters about the real cost in dollars that something like this is going to entail?
The simple fact is, I majored in economics, and one of the things I learned is sometimes you can't afford to do nothing, and that's the situation now. We can't afford to do nothing. Look, I was in Paradise, California. This is a town of 25,000 about a month ago. I drove for an hour through this town. Almost all the homes, or at least most of them, were burned right to the foundation. There was nobody there. It looked like a Hollywood sort of a post-apocalypse movie. Now, if you ask those folks, can we afford to do something? Yes, they will tell you we can afford to do something because otherwise our houses burn down. In my city, in Seattle last year, a lot of places kids could not go out to play because of the air quality was so bad for the burning forests. So the fact is that our economy is being ravaged by this threat right now. We cannot afford not to act.
One issue that the environmental movement has gotten a bad rap for historically is that it has been somewhat exclusionary to people of color. And it is many of those same people who have tended to be the most impacted by environmental disasters and degradation overall. So I want to get your thoughts on how to address that.
This is a very important concept and principle of the work we're doing, because we know we're going to have a transition to a decarbonized economy. We know we're going to transition the type of fuels we use and the type of technology we use. So there will be a transition. We have to make sure that it's not just a transition. We have to have a just transition. We have to make sure that we are attentive to the first victims of climate change that are most frequently marginalized communities, communities of poverty, frequently communities of color. And we have to build that concept into our structure of policies, and we're doing that in our state. And we know there's many things we can do in that regard. When we think about how we build infrastructure to make sure that the first victims, which are frequently marginalized communities, are helped. When we provide our training programs to help communities that have not been participated in the growth of our economy are involved. We've got to make sure that our educational system equips people and end this cycle where people have been trapped in poverty, where zip code has been your destiny. And we're fighting that right now by expanding early child education, where we can break this cycle of poverty. I know folks, I remember talking to a young woman, a Latina woman who lived in an industrial area of Seattle. She was 14, and she told me that she was 11 years old before she actually knew a child who didn't have asthma. She thought all kids had asthma. Well, when you live next to the freeway and next to the heavy industrial areas and next to a Superfund site, you experience that. So we know that we have to bring these children into the protective umbrella, and that means having a just transition. We're dedicated to that. It's got to be a very critical part of our efforts.
Boeing is a big employer in your state. I would love to get your opinion on the decision to ground a number of Boeing aircraft in the wake of crashes overseas. And is this potentially a bigger problem for Boeing going forward, especially for its economic health?
I cannot argue with this decision, particularly given the apparent similarity of the incidents. Anyone who looked at these two incidents with a new plane has to be concerned. And so I cannot argue at all with the decision to ground the planes. And I expressed that earlier in discussions with Boeing. I am hopeful that a solution can be found. The people at Boeing are remarkably innovative, and they've been able to fix things when this has happened before. Boeing had an incident with a previous model where the lithium-ion batteries were overheating, and they found a way to redistribute the heat and got the airplanes back in the sky. They should look at that as, I hope, a model to be able to find a solution to this. But the traveling public has to be protected. Boeing, on repeated instances, has shown ways to innovate around problems, and we're all hopeful that's going to happen as soon as possible, if indeed this was associated with the plane.
Finally, I want to talk about this issue that's also been roiling up both the Democratic Party, but I think overall this issue has been talked about a great deal, which is the idea of states and localities giving tax breaks to big corporations who are going to ostensibly bring jobs or keep jobs there. Amazon in New York was a big story most recently. But in your state, you were the governor when Boeing was given, I think it's now the largest tax break in U.S. history. They did end up cutting a bunch of jobs, even though they got this substantial break from the Washington state government. Looking back on this decision, would you have done it differently?
Well, I think we need to do things differently right now, which is to not allow corporations to stick a gun in your ribs and threaten to move 20,000 jobs out of your community if they don't get a tax break. We should be able
to... Is that what they said to you?
Yes, yes. I mean, these are corporate muggings. You need to understand what goes on here. Corporations basically say, if you don't give us a tax break, we're moving all of our jobs out of your community. Or they'll say, we're thinking about moving jobs, and they'll go to two or three communities and say, we want you to see who's going to give us the sweetest deal on big, giant corporate tax breaks. We should find a way to fight back against that. We should not allow corporations to hijack or blackmail communities. We have got to use, in my opinion, some things in our tax code that will not allow corporations to take advantage of communities and taxpayers like that. I have some ideas that I'll be talking in the future about to prevent that. These decisions about where to site locations should be made on good economics, not blackmail. So we continue to experience that. I know that every mayor and governor has experienced this, and we need to band together to protect taxpayers and communities. And I look forward to, if I'm given a chance to be president, to find a way to do that.
Governor Inslee, thanks for spending all this time with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington, and he's a Democratic presidential candidate.
Want to hear more from Amy Walter? Subscribe to Politics with Amy Walter wherever you get your podcasts.